The J.J. Johnson Sextet featuring Clifford Brown on trumpet, that's Capri. I'm Paul Kivy, and we have reached the end of Volume 34 of the Recorded History.
Coming up next, Native Lights. It's a podcast where Native voices shine, and that's followed by the KAXC Rewind. Good afternoon. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You may listen at KAXC.org or by asking your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much.
Buju, hello. Welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Maddie Harper DiCarlo, PhD. Maddie's a citizen of the Boys Fort Band of Ojibwe and grew up on the Leech Lake Reservation. Maddie works in philanthropy at the Bush Foundation, where she focuses on Indigenous communities. When we first chatted with Maddie, she spoke to us about the nuance of supporting 23 Native nations through philanthropy. And she also shared about learning more about her history and herself and how it fostered a sense of awe for the beauty of Ojibwe communities. So please enjoy our conversation with Maddie Harper DiCarlo, PhD, from January 2025.
When this job at the Bush Foundation came up, I still had no idea what the work would entail, but the job description said, we're looking for people who are curious and passionate and love to learn and want to make a difference. And it was just those descriptors I felt fit me and got me really excited about it. I just jumped in and tried it.
Buju, hello. Welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem.
And I'm your other host, Cole Primo. Miigwech for joining us today. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show. At its core, it's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Each and every week, we have captivating conversations with great guests from a whole lot of different backgrounds. We're talking musicians, artists, healthcare advocates, language warriors, historians, you name it. They have a wonderful mix of passions. And we talk to them about their gifts and how they share those gifts with their community. And it all centers around the big point of purpose in our lives. And here we go, amplifying Native voices. How you doing, Leah?
I'm good. I am in the middle of trying to redesign my office.
Ooh.
Right now, it's like guest rooms / office corner, and I need to make it into something a little more fun because it's the basement. It's got limited light. And do you want to hear my inspiration for my upcoming design?
Yes, yes. Let's hear it.
How about I let you guess? And it is a character that you know I like.
Okay, I would immediately think like Gandalf or something like that.
Yes, I want a wizard office.
Classic.
I thought you would get it. That's why I went that direction.
Very nice.
I want an office fit for a wizard.
Oh, yeah.
So books on books, nice desk. I want to have a dedicated screen that will play like a fireplace.
Nice.
And cozy chair. Right now I sit on an ottoman. But yeah, like a cozy chair and maps on the walls, maybe some starry wallpaper.
Get like a fog machine and just pump up the vibes. Put dust on all the scrolls.
There'll be no electricity. I'll just be sitting by candlelight with like loose leaf paper.
Love it. Love it. Can't wait to see it. Yeah.
So that's what I'm up to. Well, I'm very excited for my future new office, but not as excited as I am right now to chat with today's guest.
Mm-hmm.
Today's guest is Maddie Harper DiCarlo, and I've been meaning to talk with Maddie for a while now, so I'm really glad that she agreed to come on our program here. Maddie's a citizen of the Boys Fort Band of Ojibwe, and she currently works in philanthropy as the grant-making officer at the Bush Foundation. She's also worked in tribal-state relations, education, and as a historian. And Maddie lives with her family in Stillwater. Buju, Maddie.
Hi. Hey, Buju.
All righty, Buju, Maddie, could you just start by introducing yourself, telling us a little bit of background, where you're joining us from, all that good stuff?
Buju, Wabishkibanesikwa Indigenous Kaz, Mong Indodem, Gazagaswa Jamaica Indonjiba. So my name is Maddie Harper DiCarlo, and I grew up at the Leech Lake Reservation, born and raised in Cass Lake. I live in Stillwater, and yeah, I'm a citizen of the Boys Fort Band of Ojibwe.
We always like to ask, you know, how are you doing? How's the family?
Great. It's a snow day today, and so we've all been inside the house. Kids are a little bit restless, been doing a little work. But yeah, everybody's doing well. Everybody's healthy. I have a four-year-old son. He's in preschool. He's super lively and crazy. And then I have a 10-year-old daughter who goes to the Stillwater School District. And yeah, it's nice. My parents live nearby, actually. They moved down from Cass Lake. And then I have two sisters who both work in education and Native American education. So they live close by, too.
So, Maddie, every time we sit down with a guest, we like to kick off our conversations with a question about what you're thinking about or concentrating on these days.
So I've been doing work recently with Indigenous language revitalization activists. And so part of that work in trying to develop some partnerships and move some funding and investments into the field has been looking at the field and seeing how has the field grown in the past 20 years and what has been sort of the investment. And there's from the federal government, there's from tribal governments, but then there's also considering what has private foundations, even corporate foundations, what have foundations put into it? And looking specifically, because I'm Ojibwe, what about Ojibwe language revitalization? It's just surprising to me, not to the people, the activists who have been in the field, but just how under-resourced it's been. And while the field as a whole, like the people working in it, have just grown and evolved over the past 20 years, you know, and the field has grown, investment in it hasn't. And so, you know, thinking about how can I, in my position within the Bush Foundation, educate not just the Bush Foundation and get more investments out, but also other foundations and influence foundations and help shed light on why this is worthy to invest in, because I feel like people working in the field haven't been given a fair chance, you know, to actually do the work.
Gotcha. So you're a grant-making officer with the Bush Foundation, focusing on 23 Native nations within Bush's region, grant-making region. That's quite a few nations.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so can you say a little bit more, perhaps, about your role and how you actually work with so many tribal nations?
So my position there, I'm a grant-making officer with a focus on Native nations and communities. So this is a new position that was created in 2021. Previously, it was just grant-making officers, no kind of focus, but now we have two others that have a focus. One focuses on North Dakota and one on South Dakota. So I came in with experience doing kind of intergovernmental work coming from the governor's office and working with tribal nations, but then also my deeper knowledge of specifically Minnesota and even just nationwide from being a Native American studies professor and doing a lot of my research focused on the region helps to inform a lot of the work, because a lot of the work that we want to fund, it's difficult to understand the significance of it or the potential that the impact can have if you don't understand the whole history of colonization and context that created the problem. So I'm helping to do education within the Bush Foundation to help give context to a lot of the grants so staff can really understand the significance of the work that community is doing. And then also hopefully this year, I want to pivot more to doing more external education and trying to influence the field more. So my position is, you know, of course, I review grant applications that come in. We have several that I'm usually looking at, but one of our largest doors is the Community Innovation Grant Program. And this is open on a rolling basis. Anyone can apply at any time. It's really flexible. It's not limited to one topic. So I review those, but also a big part of my job is to do what we call sourcing. So it's to try to go out there and connect with people, go to communities and find people who have these big ideas. A lot of people aren't aware of the Bush Foundation, right? Or of these specific grant opportunities. And so when I started, you know, at Bush, coming in as an Ojibwe woman who worked with a lot of Ojibwe tribal governments. I mean, I worked with the Dakota ones as well, too. But I really noticed that a lot of our funding was going to Lakota and Dakota nonprofits, nations. It was just a result of the history of our relationships, maybe because of the staff, their relationships, kind of their community ties, things like that. And so last year I set as one of my goals was that I wanted to really source in Ojibwe communities. So I went out and I met people, you know, I talked to Gimme One Burnett. I know he was a guest on here, you know, worked with him for like 8 or 9 months, just kind of helping him talk through his ideas and kind of solidify something that would be like an investment at the scale that the Bush Foundation wants to make. And so, you know, after talking, they were awarded $8.2 million grant just in this past year. You know, kind of a historic investment for the field. So yes, my job is, you know, going out there, connecting with people, and then trying to, it's almost like coaching, you know, coaching people to kind of think bigger and bigger. Like when I first talked to Gimme One, for example, I think he wanted, you know, a much smaller scale. And we talked and I kept getting him to think bigger and bigger and bigger. And so it's like, we try to, you know, encourage people to think about like, what's your biggest vision? And then to really submit for that.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Maddie Harper DiCarlo, PhD. Maddie's a citizen of the Boise Fort Band of Ojibwe and works in philanthropy at the Bush Foundation, focusing on Indigenous communities.
Could you talk about the Bush Foundation, what it does, its goals, and then maybe what drew you to the Bush Foundation?
So it's a private foundation that was established. I think there have only been 4 presidents. We were just saying this the other day at work. 4 presidents in the history of the foundation. We have an amazing leader now. Jennifer Ford Reedy leads Bush as a president, and her leadership, I give a lot of credit to it. She's just really supportive of investments in Indian country, like has been really supportive of my position. We have a really great fellows program, Bush Fellowship program. So I know a lot of, you know, Native people have heard of the fellowship or they know people who are fellows. So we're kind of more well known for that. When I'm out and about, I might get questions about that, but then I try to kind of let people know about our other grant opportunities. A lot of it is funding for nonprofits. Really, our biggest grant program, the Community Innovation Grant Program, we're looking for ideas that are innovative, of course, and that have the potential for big impact, and not just on your immediate community, but to really transform a field. So it might have the potential to be adapted to other communities or nationwide, something like that, but that there would be a big learning and teaching element to it. So what drew me to it, it was like, I had never thought about philanthropy before I had this job. I've been in the position about 3.5 years now. And I actually come from academia, and then I left academia for public history, and then I ended up in state government for a little bit. You know, there's like one thread that goes through all of those jobs, and that was finding my role in impacting Native communities. You know, it's, and really specifically Ojibwe. I grew up at Leech Lake. I'm a descendant of Leech Lake and White Earth and Boise Fort. And as my cousin Lori was just telling me the other day, also Grand Portage, we've just found, you know, I want to be helpful. How can I kind of serve my people? So wanting to like have a life of service. And I feel like I was like searching for that for a long time, but that I just needed this period of like being out and learning. I lived in Europe for a few years after college and I was in California for 10 years, so I was away from home for a long time, but I felt like finally at this one point, I felt like I had enough, maybe knowledge or skills, or maybe it was just like confidence, but to come back home and like play some sort of a role. So teaching wasn't my thing. You know, being a professor, I loved doing research. I loved writing, but I just didn't have that passion for teaching that I hear so many people talk about. Public history, I thought, well, maybe I can help change like dominant narrative of moving away from history that emphasizes Europeans and kind of this white supremacist history to bringing in marginalized Native history and kind of centering it, that maybe that'll make a difference. And that was, you know, a great learning experience. But, you know, I was at an institution where it was just really frustrating with the politics. And then state government, I thought, okay, now I can directly work with tribal governments and play a role. But it was like I was still in all of these positions. I was kind of the outsider. I would approach Native communities and I was kind of like representing this colonial institution, right? Where they would say, oh, now you're coming from the Minnesota Hysterical Society, I heard. Like when I went to Mille Lacs and people said that, or coming, you know, from the state government, there was like trust that had to be established or distrust that had to be overcome. And when this job at the Bush Foundation came up, I still had no idea what the work would entail, but the job description said, we're looking for people who are curious and passionate and love to learn and want to make a difference. And it was just those descriptors I felt fit me and got me really excited about it. I just jumped in and tried it. And, you know, it's been like a steep learning curve learning about philanthropy, but it's just been really refreshing to actually be in a job where I'm part of an institution where I meet people and there's not this like huge guard up instantly. The Bush Foundation has more, you know, friendly social capital, I feel like in Indian country than some of the other institutions I've worked for. It's been fun because I still get to do research. I still get to learn about all these different issues as I'm doing due diligence on grant applications. And I get to talk to a lot of people and interview people and kind of like make an argument, and then channeling money to people just feels like a really solid material way to contribute.
How do you measure then the impact from the funds or the funding? Do you do that too on the other side after the funds go out?
Yeah, part of the due diligence that we conduct is determining what sort of impact are they projecting or hoping for. They usually would state what kind of outcomes they're hoping for. But then, yes, once we make those grants, there's also this important period of holding like this grantee relationship. And so it's making sure we don't just kind of, you know, give the money and then we're out of here. We really care about the work. It's like attending events and having regular annual check-in calls, but oftentimes it can be more than that just because of there can be, you know, more organic relationship that comes from doing some of the work. I like to act as a sounding board a lot of times to grantees, you know, if they might be struggling with something or something comes up, or a lot of times there are just unforeseen things that you can't anticipate. And so we're there to sort of track. They always have evaluation built into their grant as well. It's one thing Bush does is once we make the grant, we also add to that 5% of whatever the award is just for evaluation and learning. And we're there to kind of support them. We have a learning and evaluation team that talks with them about how would you like to spend this money for eval and learning. It's really up to them, but how would they like to find ways to measure their work?
What do you see as kind of the big challenges when it comes to granting money?
Gosh, for doing grants to, you know, Indian country or to Native-led nonprofits, one of the biggest challenges is providing kind of the context. At Bush, we have a larger grant-making team of about 10 to 12 people. And so when a grant comes in from an organization, say it's based on, could be Native food sovereignty or a language application. So my job is after I do the due diligence, I have to present it to the grant making committee, and I have to provide things like, what is the context to this? So always with any Native work, there's something about colonization where it's like, of course we need to do language revitalization work because of this history of boarding schools, right? Or food sovereignty work, you talk about like the reservation system, or healthcare, you talk about the Indian Health Service. Like, it always comes back to colonization, colonialism, the legacies, and that, you know, our communities are still grappling with these legacies and trying to find solutions to that. And so our team internally really needs to understand why this is exciting. Like, there was a grant to the North Dakota Native Tourism Alliance in North Dakota, and all the Native nations there came together to kind of create a tourism group. They're designing their own tours for Standing Rock or for Turtle Mountain. And so, you know, at first people thought, what's so exciting about that? What's so innovative? And so part of my work was to bring in, well, historically, there's this history of non-Native people or white people in the state having these tours or just benefiting from the tourism industry and kind of exploiting Native images and Native imagery and Native people not benefiting from that. And plus, what kind of stories are told in that tourism? And so for all these Native nations to come together and collaborate and to be designing their own work for both national and international tourists, they're like really taking control of narratives, like owning their own storytelling. And that's something that's really reversing a really long history of colonialism. So that's one aspect of it. So a lot of the work is just historicizing, providing context, doing field research, and just providing kind of that analysis of why the work in Indian country is important.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Maddie Harper DiCarlo, PhD. Maddie's a citizen of the Boise Fort Band of Ojibwe and works in philanthropy at the Bush Foundation, focusing on Indigenous communities. Maddie, how do you get people to think big?
So here's the thing is that when it comes to grants, people are used to just asking for the minimum, right? Like, what is the minimum? And they want to keep it down. So that's a big challenge. And so it's to sort of convince people that, like, I believe in their work. You know, it's asking a lot of questions, like finding out what is the work you're really doing? What changes do you want? Could you do that with just one staff? What about two staff? What about comms? What about support? What about wellness? Or, you know, and just to keep asking, I just keep asking questions. And people, you know, in the field, activists, they have been thinking about everything they need. I find a lot of people have this ongoing wish list. And so it's just a matter of eliciting it, much like your work, you know, like doing an interview, you're eliciting information and you're kind of like pulling it out of people. And when I've talked to grantees, you know, I've said like, thank you for all the work you put into this. And it's really exciting. And they've thanked me just for basically eliciting their ideas from them, pulling it, you know. And I think people have been told that they have to ask for the minimum. And kind of one hurdle to overcome too is there's a lot of, you know, nonprofits and tribal governments have experience working with federal funding. The application is onerous, but there's also like all of this reporting and there's like a lot of burdensome pieces connected to it. And so, you know, I have to sort of like convince them that there's not the same burden associated with the Bush Foundation. Like, we don't require any written reports. It's sort of all check-ins, and it really depends on me like getting out there and meeting people one-on-one, because people aren't going to come to us and share their ideas if I'm just kind of like emailing them and, you know, sending links to them.
So you talked previously about how providing for the community was like a theme throughout the various roles you've been in. Could we take a step back and just talk about where that comes from? Like, where does that drive come from and what fuels that as you go along?
That's a good question. Yeah, I think it like springs from my family, from growing up in Cass Lake, but also I think my experiences living far away and traveling a lot helped illuminate for me the specialness of where I came from and even just the beauty of Ojibwe community and people and my history. So my experience was really me going out, and it was by going out, learning about myself and my community more that way. So after college, I got certified to teach English as a foreign language because I just had this huge drive to travel. And my idea was that I thought maybe for 10 years, I'm going to hop from country to country. I thought I would spend 1 year teaching English and just move around. And I ended up staying in the Czech Republic for a couple of years. And then I was in Spain and Barcelona. I lived in New York City for a while, getting a graduate degree, a master's in international affairs. And that was a really amazing experience. I spent some time at the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues and working with activists there from, you know, all over the world, Indigenous activists. And I could speak some Spanish by then. And so I was speaking to, that was kind of like the shared colonial language, you know, some Indigenous peoples from South America and Central America. And I was doing radio work then too for Democracy Now! And this other volunteer show. And so I was like just recording people and learning so much and finding a shared identity in this broader Indigenous identity. And so then I ended up getting a doctorate in ethnic studies at UC Berkeley. I was just looking for a place where I could focus more on Native American studies. And I ended up as a tenure track professor at the University of California, San Diego. But my experience there was teaching Native American studies classes. And I was just definitely getting homesick by that point and having a hard time actually being able to come home for ceremony and things like that and being away from ceremonial life and culture. And so when I heard about an opportunity at the Minnesota Historical Society for public history role, and I came back home and it was like everything kind of was falling into place once I came back to Minnesota. And I've been moving around trying to find what is my role or trying to find out what are my gifts or how can I use my voice or whatever skills and training I have. And I definitely feel like this role at the Bush Foundation, when I have my reviews from my supervisor, they are praising things that usually in other jobs, it was like causing conflict for me. It's like speaking up, arguing different points, different talents I have are finally being viewed as positive.
Dr. Maddie Harper DiCarlo.
That's right. Thinking big. Mm-hmm. I want to think about that. Asking more questions to help myself, help others think big. I think that's a really good lesson there.
Well, for me, I think of it as like Minnesota nice to ask for the minimum and not try to, you know, reach, you know.
The tallest flower gets plucked.
Something like that. Just think big is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Miigwech to our guest, Dr. Maddie Harper DiCarlo. I'm Cole Primo.
And I'm Leah Lem. Miigwech for listening. Gigawapamen.
Gigawapamen.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Join us for the 5th Annual Grand Rapids River Fest, Saturday, September 6th, presented by KAXE, the City of Grand Rapids, and sponsored by Grand Rapids State Bank. The lineup features Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Come along for a day of great music along the banks of the Mississippi River. Tickets available now at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
That was Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. You hear it Saturdays and Sundays here on KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks so much for tuning in. This is KAXE Rewind. We receive support from Edward Jones financial advisor Christina Gallis, helping individuals and business owners reach their financial goals. More information at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, member SIPC. Coming up this weekend, it is Labor Day weekend. Hope you have plans for your Monday off, or have a good weekend even if you don't get your Monday off. And then we are full on in Riverfest week. It's Grand Rapids Riverfest is on Saturday, September 6th. We're so excited about this. We hope that you can join us, whether you buy your tickets now at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com or join us on the day of. Great performances. We are excited for our opener, Alan Sparhawk. Then it's Jeremy Albino, Margot Price, as well as Courtney Barnett. Up next, a conversation from our music director, Kari Headland. She had a chance to talk once again with Alan Sparhawk. And she talks with Alan about how this new album, he's got a brand new album that is out along with Trampled by Turtles, and what it meant for him personally as he is in the midst of this journey, too much of a word to say. He's grieving the loss of his wife, and so are so many people in the music industry. His band and his wife's band, Low, had such impact on music and the sound of music that so many people felt that loss, including Trampled by Turtles. They, again and again, were there for Alan, including at the recording of this new album, not knowing what it would end up being, and that Alan would once again find his voice, kind of a new voice, on looking at the future ahead. It is a stunning conversation. So excited to have Alan Sparhawk join us at Grand Rapids River Fest. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for tuning in this weekend.
Alan Sparhawk is a longtime fixture in the Duluth scene and really a music legend. He and his wife, Mimi Parker, are credited as inventors and pioneers of the slowcore genre through Low, Black Eyed Snakes with Charlie Parr, Retribution Gospel Choir with Steve Garrington and Eric Pollard, a.k.a. Actual Wolf, Derecho Rhythm Section, among many other things. He's now making music under his name with the 2024 album White Roses, My God, and his newest venture with another fan favorite, Trampled by Turtles. He's kicking off Grand Rapids River Fest on Saturday, September 6th. Alan joins me now on KAXE. Thanks for your time today, Alan.
Yeah, no problem. Hello to everybody.
So we have been playing your latest release a lot, which I said before earlier, you recorded with Trampled. You've magically hit that blend of it all being you, Alan, while at the same time still very much Trampled. The songs are beautiful, heart-wrenching, a little gutting sometimes. Lyrically, you talk a lot about the process of grief after losing your wife and musical partner, Mimi. What was that like to, you've released so much music in your life. What was it like to release something that was so, so personal and vulnerable?
Well, for sure, when we set out to get together and play some, record a couple songs together, I didn't necessarily envision a record. It was more just, hey, we've got some time. We've always talked about getting together and recording some tunes and playing together. And a day opened up when they were going to be in the studio. So I was able to go meet them down there. And I brought the tunes that I had. Some of them are old. Some of them were new and definitely inspired by the loss at that point. And I think it ended up going pretty well, and we've recorded more songs than I imagined we would, and that's, I guess that's when it started to feel like it could be a record or a release. But it was fun. It's definitely a new experience for me. We've known those guys a long time, and we've done shows together years before, and a few of the members have played on our records and vice versa. So it really made sense, and it really was a pretty unspoken environment. We knew what we're after. The guys are friends. They knew Mim too, and there was sort of there was sort of a reverence for the situation there. And so it was really beautiful. It was really smooth. I kind of knew that it would go easy. They're really good musicians, and we all kind of have a similar vibe and approach to just kind of standing around and working out a song real quickly and putting it down. I was nervous for sure a little bit, and it was a little bit, you know, there were tears and moments that really felt pretty transcendent and extraordinary. And I've been lucky to do a lot of different music over the years and work with a lot of different people, but this was really beautiful. It was just some friends playing some tunes together and sort of all being on the same page because of friendship and what I'd been through and their love.
Yeah. The ease, I mean, from what I had read about it and from what you just said, it sounds like it came together fairly quickly. And it's almost like that ease and also authenticity really translates with the lyrics. Like the match of that is so great. If you'd taken so much more. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Honestly, when I lost Mim, I didn't have a desire to write about it. I didn't, in some ways it felt small and sort of insignificant and almost an insult to the depth of the situation to kind of just be like, okay, I'm going to write some songs, but I've never been an intentional writer. It's more just I try to do my best to open the window and see what comes in. And yeah, it was interesting that there were a few songs for sure that couldn't help it but be written and come out of me. And I guess when that happens, you try to honor that. I was in good hands. Those guys had taken me the first summer after Mim had passed. Those guys invited me to ride along on some shows that they were doing out west and a couple different trips just to be friends and, you know, be supportive without having to, you know, soothe or come up with answers or words to address grief. It was just friendship. And yeah, it was weird. I was nervous about singing. I had still been struggling with that and you know, hearing my voice without Mims was kind of a shock and kind of disorienting to me at first. But I was with friends and I wanted to step up and do my best with it because they were bringing themselves to it 100%. And I don't know, by the time we got done mixing it, I started to become a little more comfortable with it and you know, it felt like the right way to reintroduce myself to singing and letting myself write.
Well, I wanted to ask you about, you were talking about your voice and about, because when we had talked in 2023, you talked about that very thing of just kind of not knowing your musical voice at the moment and where to go from that. And that is an obvious shift from the White Roses, My God, because you use the vocal filters throughout that album. And so when I first heard Stranger, the first single that was released from this one, that was the thing that struck me most was just your vocals right there, you know, right there and present. Just that process of figuring out what your sound was, is.
Well, yeah, the you know, the first recordings that came out of me were like you said, the White Roses, My God record was a lot more electronic, and I'm using this effect on my voice that really changes the sound, and for some reason that was a doorway to being able to sing without hearing my own voice, you know, and as crazy as that sounds, it's kind of almost like putting on a you know, a costume or putting on an act in a play or something. And there's something about sort of sidestepping your own ego a little bit and your own identity a little bit that kind of opens up the possibility for your mind to then say the things and sing the things and write the things that are in there, but that seem to get blocked when you start hearing yourself. And so I think it was important that I did that record first and sort of let myself let out what was inside me. And there were a couple songs on there that I was actually able to bring into the Turtles session and do a version with them. But yeah, going in with those guys, I was still a little anxious about my voice, and I didn't, it was really hard to get a bearing on whether what I was doing was any good. I know it sounds strange, but loss of someone who's really close to you, especially someone you work with creatively, can really be disorienting, and really, really things that you thought were so foundational are just turned on end, turned upside down, and the foundation is really pulled out from under it. But in the studio, we tracked the music kind of all standing in a circle. And then when we go back to, you kind of overdub the vocals. And I remember the time going like, man, I can't tell if this is any good. I'm questioning myself a lot here, but I felt like that because, I don't know, there was a little bit of obligation, I think, because those guys had made room for me and kind of put their trust in me, so to speak, that I kind of had to tell myself, I just need to push through and just sing, do the best I can, and trust that I'm in the hands of good people. Nat Harvey mixed the record, was really helpful in getting me to see what was good and what worked. And in doing that, I feel like I did. I found my voice. Trusting those guys, and then, some time had passed. By the end of it, I felt like I was okay with my voice, and I could look back and say, well, that sounds pretty good. And, singing is an imperfect art. You're always going to hear your own flaws, no matter how hard you work on it and how much you tweak it in the studio. But for sure, it was definitely able to come to a point where I could hear myself, and I could be happy with what I'd done. And since then, doing more shows, it's sort of settled in more. And there's definitely, I'm constantly reminded of what's missing. Mm-hmm. And I still have to work very hard to sing well. But nonetheless, I enjoy singing. I always have. And it's definitely, it's nice that its perspective has come back.
Yeah. Another voice that I find to be a central figure on the album is Ryan Young's violin work.
For sure.
That violin work is just, it cuts right to the quick. It is the way he can capture human emotion through that.
Yeah. Yeah, Ryan Young's very, very talented musician. I mean, all the guys, all the Turtles are, both Eamon, the cello player, yes. and Ryan really brought a lot of surprises and depth to the recordings. And they spent a lot of their energy and time kind of working out some really cool things. In particular, there's a song on there called Screaming Song.
That's one I was talking about, yes.
Yeah, we were there, and I said, well, here's this song. It kind of goes like this. And then I go into this section, and I kind of turned to my right to Ryan, and I said, after these couple lines, there's a instrumental section over these chords. And if you feel like, why don't you just go ahead and see what you can come up with there. And so we went into the take, and Ryan started playing this solo, and it was literally our first take, and he just absolutely blew the ceiling off. And I think there were many, we were shocked, and it was a wonder that we were able to even finish the song, because I really felt, there were multiple people in the room in tears. And that's just one example of the talent and heart and soul that he brings to everything that he does. And yeah, when we went to mix that song, I insisted that we turn that thing up as loud as as loud as they could stand it, and because it really speaks volumes. But yeah, there's so much there. There's shock, there's sorrow, there's denial, there's fear, there's anger, there's resignation, and love, all in this solo that he basically pulled right out of his head.
Well, and the surprise of when I saw the title of the song is the very first time I was listening to it, I'm thinking that you would go vocally into maybe some screaming, and then it ended up that that was the violin that did that, and it was just like, oh, I like how that flipped that a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, absolutely. When I play it with just my three-piece with my son on bass and Eric Pollard on drums, it's, you know, it's obviously a different arrangement, and, you know, we have to kind of capture that moment in a different way, and every time we play it, I think of him, and I miss that part, but yeah.
So you have been out on the road a lot. You've been in Europe twice?
Yeah, this year it feels like I've been over maybe at least maybe three times doing different legs, you know, sometimes just a couple weeks at a time, and that sort of just is the nature of that. You build tours around offers you get, and, you know, sometimes it's festivals and things like that. But yeah, we've been over there a few times, and yeah, this last time was really fun, and at least the three-piece has been, it's been really tight, and I've really enjoyed traveling with my old friend Eric, and my son Cyrus is really talented musician, and it's really just a pleasure and an honor to get to still do this.
Does it feel like, you know, talking about translating Screaming Song into the trio, what has it been like figuring these songs into that configuration?
Well, you know, I mean, I guess I like to think that most of the songs I write are kind of pretty pliable. You know, you could play them on the piano, you could play them on an acoustic guitar by yourself, or you could rock it out with electric and louder instruments. And then, you know, and of course, you know, with a larger ensemble of players. So, I don't know. Yeah, you just, you find a different version. There's definitely things that you miss, but then, you know, sometimes the different version has its own spirit, and you kind of play off that. But yeah, I've always enjoyed sort of the challenge of, okay, well, this is cool, but how are we going to play it live? And sometimes you find new things, you know, you find new ways to do it, and sometimes, you know, more visceral, you know. But I think music fans like that. I think once you're familiar with a certain song, it's, I guess I like to think that it, you know, it'd be interesting for fans to hear it, you know, this way or that way. But
I think anyone who's a fan of you understands that it might be different every single time, and that's part of the fun of it.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, letting a little bit of the secret out, it looks like we might have Dave Carroll from Turtles playing banjo with us at the show in Grand Rapids. So there'll be a little flavor from that. And we have done some shows with him. We did one in Chicago with him. It was really a highlight of the tour. And Dave's an old friend and has played with me pretty often.
Yeah. So Hollis is on the record in Not Broken. And boy, that similarity to Mim's voice is striking on that song.
Yeah. Yeah, that song is, that was a song that Mim and I had been working on at the end there and never got a chance to record. Didn't get a chance to finish it and record it, and kind of worked on it a little bit and brought it to the Turtles session. And I don't know, when we did it, I thought, well, this might be better to have. I just, you know, I knew I wanted a different voice to sing Mim's part, and it just made sense to have Hollis. I mean, I'd heard her I played music with her before, and she has her own band called Willem Dafoe Fan Club, and she writes music and sings, and I had definitely heard it before and realized that she has a very similar voice to Mim's, and it's, yeah, it's pretty, it kind of takes your breath away the first few times you hear it, and it's been nice to have her sing that. I'm not surprised, but I do get a lot of comments, and people just saying, like, wow, she really sounds like her. And, you know, that happens, you know, some of it's genetics, some of it's just because, you know, you grow up in the same house, you're going to hear that voice, you're going to hear the music, and it's family. Yeah. So it worked out well. It's cool. She's a great singer. I'm not in-
So between that and Cyrus going on tour with you, they're obviously on the music train. And as much as you enjoy playing with them, I know you do. Did that ever make you nervous that they were going down that path?
Oh, for sure. You know, there's no shortage of heartache and danger doing music, whether it's just the traveling, the characters that you run into sometimes, the dangers to your life, you know, and there's a million ways that you can get your heart broken, you know, as far as putting your heart and soul into something and it just not sticking or you know, something not working out. It's pretty treacherous, and the numbers and statistics are pretty grim, you know, for anybody endeavoring to do it. But you kind of have to, and I think the best attitude is to remember that you do it for yourself and because you love it and you get something out of it, and all the other dangers, you know, come and go if you stay true to yourself. But I think they're pretty smart. I think they recognize that it's fun to do, and sometimes things work out that you're able to do more of it. It's safe to say I know they do it for the love, yeah. And that'll pretty much get you through any dangers and disappointment for sure.
So we've not only just been playing your album, but Robert Plant just released a cover of Lowe's Everybody's Song as the first single to his upcoming solo album. Okay, and it's not even the first time that he's covered you. What is that like having someone like, I mean, I know you've met a lot of people in the industry, but that's got to be wild.
Yeah, that's really wild. That first came to be maybe, I don't know, it's probably been about 8 or 10 years ago. I don't know, somehow Robert Plant, who apparently he listens to a lot of music, listens to a lot of new music, apparently for some reason came across our CD in a record store and it caught his ear, and then it got stuck in his car for a long trip one time and he really fell in love with the music.
Is it true? It got stuck in his car?
Yeah, or that's what he says anyway. He's told us that it got stuck in his car and he had a long drive one time and he just ended up listening to it over and over again and falling in love with it and started doing covers with the band and that he was with. And, you know, if you look at his career the last 10, 15 years, that's what he does. He finds music, he finds tunes that are cool, whether they're old or new, and brings them into whatever project he's working on and whoever he's working with. So I don't know, somehow he started doing some of our stuff. The first time when he did a couple songs on the Band of Joy record, someone at some festival came up to me and started congratulating me. Like, what are you talking about? And they said, oh yeah, Robert Plant's got this record coming out with a couple of your songs on it. And we hadn't heard anything about that up until that point. And, you know, sure enough, 2 months later, it was out. And at some point after that, we met him. He came and saw Lowe in England a couple times, and it was really great. He was a really generous person in person, the kind of person who just kind of comes up, starts talking to you like a friend, and 20 minutes later, he's gone, and you feel like you've met a new friend, and that's hard to do. I mean, most people that are celebrity that you run into, you recognize pretty quickly that you need to give them their space and that they only have so much energy for people. But he's pretty generous. And yeah, it was earlier this year that I was on tour over in Europe and saw him play in Amsterdam, and kind of out of the blue, his band started playing this song, and I'm like, wow, what? And I said hello to him backstage, and he said, oh yeah, we've got a record coming out in a few months, and this is going to be the first single. But yeah, it's definitely an honor. Mavis Staples did one of our songs a few years back, and that was really an honor as well. And yeah. Chrissy Hynde from The Pretenders has a record coming out
that you're on.
Sing the duet with her, and then her and Debbie Harry sing a low song on that. And so it happens. I mean, part of it is just being around this long and people coming across your music, you know. And for anybody out there that's doing stuff, if you feel like you write stuff and you put it out more and doesn't seem to click, just don't worry about that. Just keep doing your stuff. people are going to find you, and you'll be glad that in the long run that you did what you did, and you'll have something to be proud of to look back on. And it's nice when bigger stars find things, but really the true joy is knowing that you did something that was true to yourself and that you put the work in, and that's more satisfying than selling a lot of records or playing a big show, for sure.
Yeah. Speaking of, you're playing a show in Grand Rapids, right along the banks of the Mississippi.
Big one.
Yeah. I mean, let's put big in quotes.
No, it's
Northern Minnesota.
Big festival. I don't, to this day, it's really rare. Usually it has to be some big festival or on some other bill that, you know, it's not very often that I play for more than a couple hundred people, to be honest. You know, I mean, we just got back from, you know, we did a week in England and we played four nights and there were maybe 200 or 300 people each night at different towns. And then we played a festival where there were, you know, 4,000 to 8,000 people. And that's fun, but it's rare. And again, it's on the bill with a bunch of other bands. And most of the people watching you are just there because they're curious and they've never heard of you.
Well, I think people who will be there have heard of you, you know, or just a hop, skip, and a jump away from you. But you're going to be on the bill with Courtney Barnett and Margot Price and a soul singer out of Toronto, Jeremy Albino. So we're so excited to have you a part of that day in Grand Rapids. So thanks for your time today, Alan.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for, thank you for thinking of me, and I'm glad to be there. Mim and I grew up out past Bemidji, so we drove through Grand Rapids many times, and, you know, I've been there and played at the pizza place across the way there a couple times with different bands, and I've got a lot of friends from Grand Rapids, so I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks, Alan. We'll see you soon.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks, everybody. Have a great rest of your summer.